as a nation. That was the point. Regardless of the pain and agony they suffered as individuals, now we look at the second period during the Gospel Age, this equivalent period of disfavor, which Brother Jim brought to our attention. We look down through that stream of history. What did we see? The halls were literally splattered with the blood of the dead of Israel. And yet, there were doubtless many, many in the Jewish communities who were wealthy, prosperous, did quite well. So as individuals, some prospered, some suffered. But the important thing is there was no nation. That's the key. Once there was a nation, it was cut off, then there was no nation. Now we're going to see, we've come to a time, return favor, what will happen? We'll see the return of the nation. The return of the nation within a period when we will see 6.5 million, at least that's how many they know of, went up in smoke and gas chambers. So this increased pain and agony of the individuals turns out to be the very time when their favor has returned. So it would be very easy for us to become confused were we to look at the fate of individuals during all this time period. So we'll want to look at it only from the standpoint of the nation. And yet, within that, and at the close of each portion, we notice a key feature. There is generally the aspect as it applies to the individuals. For example, when we looked at the house of servants back there in Jesus' day, whenever Jesus healed anyone or performed some act, he told them, "Now go show yourself to the priests." He was performing all this as a witness and as an activity directed towards the nation. Finally, the nation would be cut off, 33 AD. Then favor goes to a faithful remnant class out of Israel on an individual basis. And we're going to see that their recovery will be almost the same way, won't it? They will be recovered as a nation, and then finally life will come to them when they accept their Messiah, accept Jesus as their Messiah. Will they accept their Messiah as a nation? Or will they accept him as their Messiah in their heart as individuals? The latter, of course, is what God is interested in. He doesn't care if they pass some congressional, some piece of paper in their Knesset which says, "We now officially acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah." No, it's got to be in here, in the hearts of individuals. Until that happens, they are not truly alive. So you pass through this national period, then individuals put the final finish. In the case of the heavenly house, during the Gospel Age, we see that they were dealt with on a group basis. Christendom had been a golden cup in the Lord's hand. They were dealt with collectively. And yet, finally, collectively, they would be rejected. And yet there would be a period of favor to a select remnant, the period from 1878 to 1881. And then thereafter, rejected totally, you now have individual replacements. Notice that we are in an individual replacement period now, aren't we, for the church? We all see that. And notice that finally, when we are completed as the Lord's body, as individuals, that's when we will expect to see Israel's favor and life return, because they will be expected to receive their Messiah as individuals. These individualized programs all come together at the same time. Okay, now We also want to notice that in each instance, we don't want anyone to misunderstand that while the Lord dealt with Christendom, you might say, collectively, or evaluated, judged them collectively, that he was not also dealing with each of us as an individual. That, of course, is true. We all make individual consecrations, and that was always true. And that is also not different from the way the nation was dealt with, of Israel, was dealt with during their period of favor as a nation. Even though God was dealing with them on this national level, still individuals within that system were also an important criteria, very, very important. In fact, you recall in John 1:47, Jesus sees Nathanael and refers to him as an Israelite indeed. So there were those in Israel, even though she was being judged, dealt with as a nation, the individuals could be isolated out of there as being very important. We see then that the order is a house, then to individuals. Jesus, his body. The recovery is the same. Jesus was the first, the head, then his body. Israel, the nation, and then the individuals. Now then, the fact that we see the nation of Israel recovered over there, and we notice that many Jews are almost totally atheistic, have no confidence in the promises or anything, we see that that's irrelevant. That has nothing to do with the issue at all. It was the nation that was recovered, not the individuals. Their hearts will be recovered later, won't they? When they will be given a heart of flesh. When the ancient worthies on the scene will take care of that matter. Because that covenant, the new old law covenant, will be made not with a nation. It will be made with individuals. It's a perfect law, perfect covenant. It must be made with perfect people, the ancient worthies. And then who will be Israelites indeed then? Why, those who come in under that arrangement. Will it be those in the nation over there? It has, I think, been wisely suggested that there are those children of Bible students who have not gone on to consecration but are well familiar with the divine plan, who are far more likely to fall in line with that incoming arrangement than, let's say, a Jew who's a virtual atheist over in Palestine this very hour on some kibbutz somewhere. Who do you think would be the more ready to accept the kingdom which they see? Who then is going to be the first so far as being an Israelite indeed is concerned in that new arrangement? So it will be an individual program then. Okay, now, this replacement program is an important one, and that's what we're going to discuss now. Now, you may notice a lot of chronology here. Prophecy involves chronology. Now, we're going to take us up to about 67. We'll talk about some of the events today, and only a broad brush as to what we might see in the future. The reason for that is because of Brother Russell's very clear statement that prophecy is never clearly understood until either fulfilled or in course of fulfillment. So we can talk clearly about what's already happened. But if you think I'm going to be able to give you a detailed outline of what's going to happen next year and the year after, well, your guess would be as good as mine. But we can really appreciate the prophecy and the things which we have seen. Remember the Jubilee picture, the 70 years which were determined upon his people? Volume 2, we talk about the Jubilee. There we see that because they failed to keep it, that you had 19 periods with the Jubilees, and then you took the 51 without, times the 49 years, missing jubilees. We got the 2499 years. We added it into the start of that program, brought us to 1874, very important period. And we see that that's where the jubilee began. The jubilee is always an illustration of recovery. See how interwoven this prophecy is. Had Israel not failed, the jubilee, those 70 jubilees, would have indicated their whole picture. 70 full jubilees would be 3,500 years, not 2499. Add that to the same midpoint and you come to 2874, the end of the millennium. It would have been Israel's privilege, working with the church, to be the agency to bring mankind to this final perfection. Now, they will do it all right, but they're going to have to do it under the church, and they're going to have to do it at the hands of many who were not Jews by birth or heritage, you might say, ingrafted individuals. Now, talking about that ingrafting, and again emphasizing this question of how important it is to see this twofold issue, and the fact that even ourselves are included as the 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, we refer to Romans 11. Now here we see, I say then, verse 1 and 2, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. Here he sees that there is a future hope for Israel. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. And then also, we'll skip down to 5 and 8. We're going to move rapidly because we have so much to do. For so then at this present time also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if by grace, then is it no more of works? Otherwise grace is no more grace. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. Now here we see that they had an opportunity to constitute the 144,000, lost that opportunity, it passes off to the Gentiles. Now the remainder of that discussion is an important one. The Apostle Paul brings to our attention that the Romans shouldn't feel too proud at being Gentiles. He says, now it is true that they were broken off, as it were, for your sake, that you might have an opportunity. But don't feel too proud about that. For if wild branches were broken off, or natural branches broken off, and wild branches were grafted into this olive tree, he says, I would remind you how much easier it would be to graft in natural olive branches. Now, I think this was not merely a warning or reminder, but prophetic. I think it's prophetic of what we see at the time of our Lord's second advent and the beginning of the recovery of the nation of Israel. For this is what Brother Russell brings to our attention in connection with Rabinowitz and the movement at that time. We're now quoting from Parallel Dispensations. This would be Volume 2. And we have page 223, Volume 3, rather. He now states the following. The exact year of Israel's rejection, yes, even the very day we know, that they were to have a mission or double, the prophet explicitly declares. That this parallel period is 1845 years long, and that it ended A.D. 1878. We have shown clearly. We think, and that it was marked by favor is an indisputable fact. We see what that favor was, that for the first time, and we saw how brutally they were treated all down through those years, they had an opportunity to return to Palestine and to own property. This was not permitted under the Turks. The Berlin Congress was there. Disraeli was on the scene. Sun never set on the British Empire. And with all that power, this first, last, and only Jewish prime minister was able to force from the Turks the privilege of Jews once again able to own property in Israel. We see what an irony this was. In 1848, there was an elected Jew to Parliament. We saw it was Baron Rothschild. As Brother Jim pointed out, at that time, he was not even permitted a seat. Let's see now. 30 years later, that's when a man comes of full age under Jewish arrangement, isn't it? There would be Benjamin Disraeli, prime minister. And he would be forcing the ability to own land from the Turks. I might mention that they would become a nation in when? 1948? A nice round century after 1848. 1848, we found that Baron Rothschild was not permitted his seat in Parliament. 100 years later, there would be a Jewish Parliament in a Jewish state, and the Knesset was formed. And bear in mind, too, that it is since the end of their double that Professor Delitzsch has published his Hebrew translation of the New Testament, which is already in the hands of thousands of Hebrews and awakening much interest. And further remember that the greatest Christian movement among the Hebrews since the days of the apostles, headed by Rabinowitz and others, is now in progress in Russia. And it had its start about as long a time after 1878, namely 3.5 years, where Israel's double ended, as the time of the awakening among the Gentiles was after Israel's rejection in A.D. 33. Sure enough, Rabinowitz is on the scene, 1881, doing this work. Now, we know that the replacement program began in 1881. There we saw the Lord's body complete in number. And we saw that the replacement program began from outsiders. We are all such. Would it be surprising then that at that very moment that replacement program from outsiders should for the first time also be offered once again to Jews whose favor had once again returned? Shouldn't surprise us at all, should it? Sure enough, there's Rabinowitz making that presentation. Now, it's been argued that the program fizzled out and didn't go very far and amount to much. I would remind you, as we look at this convention today, that the Bible student movement under Brother Russell fizzled out too, didn't it? Yes, we're the fizzled out remains of this program. It was big, but it has to become smaller, smaller, smaller. And the important thing is that the offer be made. It's God's character, His nature. The promise was made to Abraham, He would always see to it that the Jew would be first in all things. He didn't guarantee that they would accept it any more than they would accept it at Jesus' first advent. But it would be offered, and it was so. Now, we also see that Jeremiah 18:17 turns out to be at that same time. I think that was brought up earlier. And here we see that Jeremiah 18:17 is the one that refers to, I believe Brother Jim mentioned it, I will scatter them as with an east wind before the enemy. I will show them the back and not the face in the day of their calamity. This refers to their period of disfavor. But Acts 3:19-21 tells us that repent ye therefore and be converted or turned around, that times of refreshing might come out of the face of Jehovah. And he shall send Jesus Christ, whom before was preached unto you. Who's he talking to? He has to be talking to the Jews. And he's asking them to become a part of this Christian program. And if that's the case, and it applies at the time of the Lord's return, then it can refer to only those Jews who might be on the scene at the time of this Rabinowitz movement. We believe that it is prophetic of this beginning at that time. So we see that that's brought to our attention also through these experiences. The Rabinowitz movement has always been an impressive thing to me, as it showed this parallel program. Now, the return of favor to Israel also marks a period of trouble. We've talked about that before, that we shouldn't assume that the return of favor to the nation would not be a period of trouble. In fact, we could call it Jacob's trouble. If Jacob represents the nation and the nation is to be returned, then we shouldn't be surprised if we see that it is returned in very great trouble. Brother Russell reminds us that Jacob's trouble begins there. If her favor begins in 1878 as a nation, that's where Jacob's trouble begins. The fact that that trouble continues and will have a final portion which will produce life in that nation does not mitigate that against that fact. Here we have in 1895, December 1st, reprint 1898, "Yes, we are in the time of Jacob's trouble, and we shall not be surprised if bitterness against the race shall reach such intensity as to expel them from Austria, Germany, France, Spain, and Portugal, possibly from England. The Lord has promised to gather the remnants of Israel, that they shall come back to their own land with weeping and with supplication." And indeed they have. We recall that the horror of the Holocaust and all did bring them back with weeping and supplication. Jacob's trouble has produced a time so severe on individual Jews that rather than that they were welded together again for the first time as a nation. So terrible that mankind themselves were ashamed and formed what we find over in Palestine today, the nation of Israel. He adds also, this is in reprint 593, 1884, "The scriptures also teach that while other nations fall during the day of the Lord," well now isn't that a puzzle? Why should these nations fall? Because you cannot have the recovery of the nation of Israel and the return of her favor without disfavor coming upon the nations of Christendom. And we'll see how that is paralleled throughout also. Now, we also notice in this same portion, Zechariah 12:3, "God declares that he will deliver them, though all the people of the earth be gathered against them." Verse 10 describes their recognition of him whom they have pierced, and their sorrow when in that day God pours upon them the spirit of grace and supplication. The spirit of grace and supplication. He's going to pour upon them his spirit. We shouldn't be surprised then to see that this is very similar to Ezekiel 37, which chronicles the recovery of the nation. Remember how the nation was shown as bones fully dried and scattered throughout all the earth. They had been scattered through the north parts of the empires of Europe. And we see in Ezekiel 37 that they begin to come together, bone to bone, tied together as a nation. And then finally, it stands on its feet, sinew, muscle, skin, and it's a great army. Israel recovered as a nation. But the prophet went on to show that there was no breath in it, no life as yet. The spark of life had not yet been ignited. And so they are regathered in unbelief. Their nation is a nation which does not recognize their Messiah. They will not see that until he pours the Spirit of grace and supplication upon them. Now, that will not take place until the church is complete beyond the veil, the ancient worthies come upon the scene, and they have an opportunity to fully recognize their situation and have it explained to them. Now, also, around 1910, we see the Hippodrome address. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and announce that her warfare has ended. That ended in 1878. The Zionist movement begins. The fishers begin their work. We see that about this same time, who is proclaiming all this? Charles T. Russell. Brother Russell is reminding one and all of the restoration of Israel. It seemed mad at the time. And it seemed equally insane to believe that the kings of Europe, the mighty empires that had seized control of this whole planet, would one day fall and be totally crushed and gone. That was just not possible. Britannia ruled the waves. India, Africa, China, nations everywhere, Russia, they were all run by kings, all part of those empires. The Belgian Congo was many times larger than Belgium itself. And France's holdings far exceeded the size of France herself. Yet, Brother Russell announced it would and must come. In 1914, the crash does come. She's broken in pieces. And with it, her stranglehold on her empire having been broken, we find that the opportunity for Israel is parallel. For as they went down, Israel comes up. These things are exactly parallel. All this was announced in this Hippodrome address in 1910. And from that, Brother Russell suggests, Zionism is trembling in the balances and fearful of coming to naught. It has spent its force along the lines originally inaugurated. The program of the fishers is coming to a close, you see. But it will not fail, as many fear. Without assuming the role of a seer, I answer you that Zionism is about to take on fresh vigor, that its most prosperous days are yet to come. According to my understanding of the Hebrew prophets, the time of Jacob's trouble is not yet ended. Further pogroms of Russia may be expected, and further atrocities in Romania and elsewhere. It is sad indeed to be obliged to admit that these tribulations will probably come to you from professed Christians. How ashamed I feel of those who thus dishonor the name and the teachings of my master, I cannot find words to express. Today we find that papacy was involved intimately in the destruction of the Jews during the whole period of Hitler's Europe. We find that they are being called to account, that they themselves helped ship the Jews out of Italy and elsewhere and into Europe. Now, let's take a look at our chart over here and for a moment take a look at some of these parallel periods. We see in 1874 the inspection beginning. And we're going to look at it from twofold standpoint, the standpoint of Christendom and the standpoint of natural recovered Israel. The reason is because as one goes down, the other comes up. So we So we want to be able to see that very carefully. 1874, the king comes in, the inspection begins. We find as a result of that inspection that Christendom is rejected and found wanting. We find as a result of that inspection, favor is returned to the nation of Israel. Favor begins. God turns his face back to them. During that period from 1878 to 1881, there is a brief period of during which that rejection had taken place, where a faithful remnant class is dealt with. And this same period of tentative favor through 1881 takes place, the Berlin Congress of Nations, and then in 1881 the replacement program begins on the, as far as the spiritual program is concerned, and we see the beginning of an opportunity, at least, for Jews to be regrafted into that program, as illustrated by that Rabinowitz movement. We see that in 1914, Christendom is destroyed. That destruction is begun there on a national level. We see that the nation of Israel is begotten at about that same time. Historically, what takes place is this. The war is about to begin. They all sense that. Once the war begins, there was a rapid struggle to see who would be the first to proclaim themselves in favor of a Jewish state, a Jewish national homeland. That's surprising, but the Kaiser in Germany was actively working on just such a program. You see, they had a feeling at that time that whoever would enlist the aid of the Jew would win the war. Turns out it's true, too. But that was their feeling. And then, of course, what happened was Britain came out first in proclaiming their support for a Jewish homeland. This miffed the Kaiser, and unfortunately, this was passed on to Hitler and his cronies a little later on. So this marked the beginning of a declared statement for the nation. We might say the nation was begotten there. Now, this is a little later, right after the war started, around 1915. We'll observe that 1945 is again the same 30-year period we keep talking about, which pertains to the period of coming to full age. Now, a strange thing happens during this same period. We see multiple steps. The Balfour Declaration in 1917, when this is expanded upon and made more official. The end of the war in 1918, and the formation of the League of Nations, when this is reiterated again. So the formation of a true Jewish homeland is now very clear in the minds of everyone. It's official, there are documents, nations are now standing behind it. Preeminently, the British Empire. However, there is a certain snag here. Now that the war is over and they're no longer worried about losing it, the ardor for a Jewish homeland begins to fade. And we find Israel being pressured by the British Empire. Well, let's not give them quite as much land as all that. I'm sure they won't need all of that. And so it begins to be pared away. By the time we get down here to 1945 and 1948, what do we find? Do they say, well, we'll give you what we finally have left? Finally, the Jews have to agree to partition. And they say, well, what exactly does that mean? And they say, what it means is this. The whole area is up for grabs. And on June 6th, whatever you poor Jews can hang on to, you get to keep. Whatever the Arabs get belongs to them. Then they confiscated all of their arms, walked out and left them naked and said, probably the Arabs ought to be able to handle it now. And so that should be the end of this Jewish problem. And if all the Jews are killed and pushed out into the sea and the nation never materializes, well, who can say it's our fault? After
After all, we did our best. And that was the attitude at that time. And even then, they were forced into the acknowledgement of the nation. About this time, 45 to 48, there's a haberdasher from Independence, Missouri, by the name of Harry S. Truman, who's president of the United States. And he decides, and his own memoirs suggest, that he wanted to see to it that the Jews had a homeland. He was so moved by what had happened to them down through this whole period. And he said he wanted to do that for his God. He was a Bible reader, and he realized how important that was. But he said, I won't do it through the United States. He says, the British said that they would do it, and he says, it's time they came across with their promise. And he exerted enormous pressure from the United States and forced the British into finally coming through with the white paper and the British mandate and all the rest of it. So it all really was handled over there by Great Britain, as we see, but not very happily. Surprisingly, 40 million Arabs did not push them out. Israel survives. Now, as we look back, we see some other rather remarkable things. We see that they become a nation in 1948. Their beginning way back there in 1878 was exactly 70 years. They went into captivity originally in 606 BC, as we see, and it was 19 years prior to that, 19 years prior to their 70 years captivity, that King Nebuchadnezzar put the arm on them, you might say, and said, look, I'm running this program around here, and the Jewish nation is to be vassal to me. And at that time, Jerusalem was lost in the siege of Jerusalem at that time. 19 years later, they tried to sever themselves from Nebuchadnezzar. He said, I've had enough of that. He seizes them. They go into captivity for 70 years. The nation is lost for those 70 years. We see their recovery occurs the same way. 70 years, they become a nation, but with all of that fighting, they could not get the city. They were unable to recover Jerusalem. But 19 years later, they would get the city in 1967 in the June War. So we see this exact parallel in reverse. 19 years, the city falls. 19 years later, the nation in recovery. 70 years, the nation is recovered. 19 years later, Jerusalem. We see also the Jubilee as an illustration of recovery comes into this picture. In 1917, we find that was the year that General Allenby took his troops, Jewish troops, mind you, fighting for Britain, along the Exodus Trail and took Jerusalem in 1917. And British troops, because the Turks didn't like that, British troops, Jewish troops, for the first time were able once again to worship at that Wailing Wall. Jerusalem was freed. Jerusalem would now become a kind of open city under the Palestinian protectorate, but it would not belong to them until exactly 50 years later, in 1967, they would take Jerusalem again. Jewish troops would again take Jerusalem. Only this time it would be in a Jewish army, and they would never give it back. So we see all of these stately steppings. Now, what's happening to Christendom meanwhile? Destruction in 1914, the wind, as we picture the illustration of Elijah on the mountain. What did he see in his vision? First, there was the wind that rent the mountains, even as the stone smote the image and broke it in pieces. The wind rent the mountain in pieces. 1914. 1917, the earthquake revolution begins, particularly the Bolshevik revolution in Russia. The first of the kings falls. Notice that corresponds to the same time period when Jerusalem falls into the hands of Jews for the first time. We see that the fire begins not long thereafter, and particularly in 1918. And I would remind you that anarchy, more particularly, is an independence of thought. Monarchy is a form of government. One man tells everyone what to do. Anarchy is nobody tells anybody what to do. That's just about where we are, aren't we? We've come to the point where no one has respect for government, where everyone feels that the government is the problem, not the solution, and are looking eagerly forward to the improvement in the economy this fall because the government will be involved in getting itself reelected. And so, thank goodness, we'll leave us alone for a few months so we can get something done. So that's the world in which we live. And that's what's rapidly happening. So this fire goes on. Where is the kingdom? Is it in a great blast of wind which will finally crush everything out? Is it in a great earthquake that will just shatter society to its foundations? It's all happened, hasn't it? Is it in the great fire of anarchy which will just burn everything out? It's in the still, small voice. It's only when mankind is in a state where he's willing to listen are we going to see the kingdom come in. It's not going to come in with a great shout and blast, dear friends. It's going to whimper on into that kingdom, listening to a still, small voice when mankind is used up. Speaking of anarchy and trouble, what about Israel's lot today? What do we see as we examine Israel today? And by the way, we should always examine Jacob's trouble, Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38:39, Zechariah 14. Examine all of that and observe that it's chariots and horsemen and all of this that are always brought against Israel. These represent organizations, doctrines. They're all symbolic. If they're literal, Israel would never have to worry about it. A few tanks could easily take care of a few chariots. And give me one machine gun ought to handle a few people's spears and arrows. It can't be any real problem there. So, and goodness knows what you could do with a jet fighter. So we all know that these are symbolic. So therefore we must apply the symbology correctly. And when did all of that, were those organizations and whatnot brought against her? We saw that the nation was begotten here with the formalization of these papers. It shouldn't surprise us then that at that very time, that was when we saw the organizations, the nations, doctrine or concept after concept was raised against Israel to try and whittle her down, and it has never stopped. Even after she was formed in 48, every effort has been made to try and put an end to her. Even the United Nations. Have you ever noticed that whenever these wars began from 1948 on, even 1967, the Arabs attack Israel, nobody says anything. The Arabs are defeating the Israelis, nobody says anything. The Israelis finally gather themselves, throw the Arabs back. Victory is now moving in their direction, and there's a great hue and cry comes up from all over the world and the UN saying, well, this is horrifying. This simply must, we have to put an end to this. Day late and a dollar short all the time. Anyone with an ounce of common sense should be able to see that there is a great deal of anti-Semitism in this world, everywhere. All nations are gathered against Israel. There can't be any question about it. But what does God do? We have all of them suffering as a result. They're going to destroy Israel. They find themselves destroyed. Britain sought to preserve interest on behalf of the Arabs, maintain the Suez Canal, and maintain her control over the oil in that area. The result was her compromise against Israel was Israel survives, she loses the Suez Canal, and all the rest of it, plus her entire empire. It has all happened against them. Those who move against Israel will find themselves punished as a result. Our time is virtually gone. We'll look at a few more things. What has happened is we now find that the Arabs themselves, who were so bitterly attacking Israel throughout all of these years, are now in flight and severe trouble. We have them fighting against each other now, Iraq, Iran. In fact, the Iranians are even selling lots of oil now to the Israelis because they need Israeli weapons. And of course, the Jews are perfectly content to sell them weapons so that they can shoot each other up some more. So we see the further parallel crumbling of the false religions. We see the Russians moving into Afghanistan. Now, as an American policy, of course, we must see the red flag marching into Afghanistan, feel sorry for the Afghans, and look with horror upon this whole program. In reality, of course, we see that we have a society which is serving a false god. Christendom has seen its day, now Mohammedanism must see its. Sad to say, before the dust all settles, though the Afghans get their country back, those religions will fall. And it seems that Russia is one of the few tools that can be used in that way. The mighty United States tried to pull the Catholic Church's chestnuts out of the fire in Vietnam, and while we could incinerate this planet, we could not beat those peasants over there in Vietnam. Why? We weren't fighting for ourselves or the Vietnamese. We were fighting for the old church against God's chariot, and we just got run over, that's all. Don't stand in the way of God's program. You'll just get run over. Well, what about a time of trouble? We talk about difficulties, anarchy, and so on, individualistic thinking. Take a look sometime at what's happening in Israel today if you think things are very good. In Israel, this very hour, women are going shopping with their baby on their arm, carrying a machine gun on the other. And they're worried about terrorists everywhere. Terrorists everywhere. Dear friends, we have become so benumbed by terrorism that we now think that that's ordinary and somehow think that terrorism will one day yet come. Whereas over there, we see that terrorism is now almost an integral part of Jewish society. And we have terrorist Jewish groups. That's another thing that we see. There are terrorist Jewish groups. Judea and Samaria, the land is growing. What about Lebanon? The Jews moved into Lebanon. All we saw it was a war. Jews going up there to push some PLO out of Lebanon. I want you to see how God works. The Israelis moved up, took Lebanon. They called it freedom for Galilee. That was what the war was called for them on their side. You see, that is the land of Galilee. And they went all the way up to just south of Beirut, right into Beirut. Just south of Beirut was the limit of one of the cities where Jesus visited in Galilee, the man of Galilee. They didn't go up into Lebanon. They actually went up to what belongs to them. All that belongs to them. All that was promised to them under this Balfour Declaration. They just didn't get it, that's all. No wonder Menachem Begin, when once asked, said, "We don't have any captured Arab territory. We have only liberated Jewish territory." It's true, isn't it? But the nations of the world said, how dare those Jews do that? That's just terrible. They're always fighting, always fighting. It looks as though we're going to have to show them how to keep peace. So, and a UN peacekeeping force was arranged. The Americans moved into that area. What has happened? Well, we got 200 and some Marines blown up. Everybody else is getting shot up. We find ourselves with the Navy there shelling local villages, just like the Jews did. We find ourselves bombing Syrian positions, just like the Jews did. In fact, we find ourselves talking to the Jewish security forces to find out which are the best ones to bomb now. We have come away from that experience now realizing that Israel knows what she's doing. There is a renewed respect for the nation of Israel. In fact, in case you didn't know it, not long after we pulled the Marines out of there, Reagan signed a mutual defense arrangement with the Israeli government concerning defense in that area. We now realize that they're going to have to run their own affairs, that they really do understand. And so respect begins. Judea and Samaria begins. Many American Jews are now leaving and going to Israel. Once again, there is a kind of renewed exodus to Israel from the United States. This group seems to have a very low turnover rate in this effort to go to Judea and Samaria. What remains? More of the same, I'm afraid. It will just go on like that, and we can't expect much else because, you see, it's all waiting on us. We're going to have to finish up, aren't we? We can't wait for the nation to be restored. It already is. We can't wait for the world to come to a recognition and appreciation of Israel. They never will until we're there to force it upon them with the instrument and agency of the ancient worthies. All that can be done has been done. All the world can do now is wait for the still small voice. And it's going to be the voice of the Lord, and we'll be with him. So that's the future. It turns out that almost all of Brother Russell's future has become our past, and what remains is for you and I to make our calling and election sure. And we're going to have a sad event shortly, sad yet joyous, a baptismal discourse as others enter this race, and it means that some have dropped out. Some have dropped out, tired of the game, and another has been asked to leave the bench and come forward. That must not happen anymore. We're going to make our calling election sure, and that is not going to happen anymore. Let's help one another make our calling and election sure. Let's realize how precious those three individuals are that we will see today, and make sure that they make their calling and election sure. These are important things. Let us not fail the Lord. Let's not fail our brethren, and let's not fail ourselves. May the Lord bless and keep you.
Thank you, Brother Rodney.